And we'll have two separate lines, and then the questions will alternate from one line to the other. If I might ask you, please, to make your questions questions. Statements without an uptick of inflection at the end indicating a question are just not okay. This is a forum for Drs. Walt and Mearsheimer, not for you, if you are inclined to do that. So please don't. Make your questions succinct. Make them questions. Just to look forward a little bit, after we are finished here, Drs. Walt and Mearsheimer will sign their book at the back. The retail price of the book is $26. We are selling it for $20. But if you would like to pay $26 to benefit the World Affairs Council, we won't object. So it's all yours, gentlemen. Is there anyone with a question? Bob Hornstein, thank you. I suspected that you might have one.
I've got a lot of them. Why do you seemingly have no problem with the massive pro-Arab effort funded by Arab oil money to win friends in high places, to influence American foreign policy, to promulgate the Arab line on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Do you believe that it's in America's best interest, for example, to support Saudi Arabia, which denies freedom of religion to non-Muslims, fosters religious hatred in its schools, and deprives women of fundamental human rights? That's a question.
A couple of points. I'd question the premise of the question that there is a massive Arab campaign to shape and lobby in the United States. There's some lobbying done by the government of Saudi Arabia and by others. They hire professional lobbyists in Washington, and they occasionally are able to persuade the United States to sell them, not give them, but sell them some arms. There is occasionally other money that comes in, but the idea that there is a massive amount of Saudi or Kuwaiti oil money coming into the United States and shaping our discourse and controlling what we think in this country, I think, is at odds with reality. Second, I think we ought to be very critical of certain aspects of the Saudi government's policies. The fact is, we don't support Saudi Arabia because we like the way they run their society. We support Saudi Arabia because Americans are addicted to oil. And as long as we all like to drive SUVs and heat our homes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as long as the world economy runs on petroleum, Saudi Arabia is going to get a free pass on at least a number of issues, whether we like that or not.
Second microphone, please.
Hi. I saw you guys on C-SPAN, and you got a hard time from people, so I gave you a lot of credit for giving it your best shot. Can you explain sort of the relationship, which from the outset seems sort of bizarre, between fundamentalist Christians and hardcore Jews in Israel?
Take that one again.
Was everyone able to hear that question? Let
me see if I get the question. Could we explain the relationship between fundamentalist Christians and the Israel lobby or in Israel itself? There is a subset of the Christian evangelical movement, usually known as Christian Zionists. I've alluded to one of the major groups, which is called Christians United for Israel. It's run by a man named John Hagee, who has a big church in San Antonio, Texas, I believe. This is an offshoot of a brand of Christian theology known as dispensationalism, which believes that you can read the future by looking at Old Testament prophecy in various ways. And they believe that before the Second Coming, before we get to the end times, a series of events have to take place that are preordained in the Old Testament. And, of course, the reestablishment of the State of Israel, Israel's conquest of Jerusalem in the Six-Day War, are seen by Christian Zionists as key signs leading to the Second Coming. Therefore, they are extremely ardent pro-Israel, and in particular, they oppose any form of two-state solution because, in their view, God gave this land to the Jews and all of it, all of Palestine. And, of course, this is all designed to bring about the Second Coming. That's what explains the basic relationship. The relationship between Israelis and the Christian Zionists is an interesting one because, of course, the Christian Zionists also believe that eventually Jews ought to convert, right? And so there's a certain ambivalent relationship there, but at least at this point in American domestic politics, a useful tactical alliance. our view is that we shouldn't be basing American foreign policy on Old Testament prophecy. Partly because there's separation of church and state here in the United States, which we think is a good thing, and second, because the Old Testament is not a very good guide to foreign policy.
I ask about two names that our speakers mentioned that I believe need clarification. Representative Paul Findlay, who was mentioned, I believe, or at least I'd like you to clarify, did he feel that the problem in our legislature is that AIPAC and other influential groups have the legislature sympathetic to Israel, or if the legislature is intimidated in behalf of Israel? And then why would a colleague of Professor Walt at Harvard go out of his way, his name is Dershowitz, to see that a fellow Jew, Professor Finkelstein at DePaul University, did not get tenure?
I'll take a crack at that question. With regard to Paul Findlay, as Steve pointed out in his comments, was a congressman from Illinois who was defeated in good part by the lobby, which was deeply unhappy with him. And Findlay's basic argument, and it's an argument that we share, is that there are a number of congressmen and senators who are naturally sympathetic to Israel and therefore don't need the lobby's pressure to push them to support pro-Israel policies. On the other hand, there are lots of congressmen and lots of senators who are not naturally inclined to be sympathetic to Israel. That's not to say they'd be hostile to Israel, but they would probably have a more critical view than those who are naturally sympathetic. And those are the individuals that the lobby leans on, and leans on very successfully. As Steve pointed out, Steve Rosen indicated that he believed that he could get the signatures of 70 senators very quickly on that napkin. And he's basically correct. All you have to do is look at congressional votes on issues relating to Israel, and they're overwhelmingly supportive. Again, this is why Osama bin Laden was so interested in targeting Capitol Hill. With regard to Alan Dershowitz and Norman Finkelstein, Norman Finkelstein wrote a book entitled Beyond Chutzpah, which was essentially a direct attack on Alan Dershowitz's book, The Case for Israel. And I think it's fair to say that there was bad blood between the two of them before Norman Finkelstein wrote Beyond Chutzpah. But after Finkelstein wrote Beyond Chutzpah, Alan Dershowitz redoubled his efforts to go after Norman Finkelstein, and this is a well-established fact, went to considerable lengths to convince the administrators and the faculty at DePaul University that Finkelstein should not get tenure.
Well, second thank you microphone. Both for coming to Portland and sharing with us. As political analysts, you have looked at actions by various international players, the United States being the 800-pound gorilla on the political stage, and you have looked at the various benefits or liabilities that those actions have resulted in for the United States and for, in this case, this lecture, Israel. The neoconservatives are pushing the current administration to attack Iran. And I would like to ask you, what do you see as the benefits for the United States from such an attack, and what do you see as the benefits for Israel from such an attack?
I'll take a swing at that, and John can add anything that I leave out. I think the benefits to the United States of an attack on Israel or an attack on Iran are almost non-existent. I think it would be an enormous strategic blunder. That's not to say that Iran itself and some of its policies and certainly its nuclear ambitions aren't a problem that the many people, including John and me, see as a real problem. The question is, what's the best way to deal with that problem? And it seems to me, first of all, it's threatening a country with regime change, as we have been doing for the last 10 years or so, is not the way to convince it that it doesn't need a nuclear deterrent. Second, trying to take out that nuclear capability is just another way of getting them to redouble their efforts, because it's not going to destroy the knowledge they've acquired on how to acquire a nuclear capability. It's just going to delay the process. Meanwhile, it's, of course, going to lead them to retaliate against us in a whole variety of ways in any way they can. It's going to reinforce the idea that is widespread in the Arab and Islamic world that the United States really is trying to dominate that region and has an insatiable appetite for beating up on Islamic countries. It will certainly give Iran even more incentive to funnel aid to groups like Hezbollah or Hamas. So I think that's a problem, but I think it's a problem that you can only deal with by trying to reach a modus vivendi with Iran, not by going to war with them, and I hope we don't do it. Now, from an Israeli perspective, I can understand, if I were an Israeli, wanting the United States to take out Iran's nascent nuclear capability. And remember, they're just trying to get control of the nuclear fuel cycle here. We don't know if they want to get weapons or not. Probably they do at some point down the road, or they at least like to have the option to do that down the road. If I were an Israeli, I could see it being very attractive if the United States would eliminate that problem. But again, it doesn't eliminate it for very long. It pushes it down the road a few years, and it doesn't necessarily solve the problem long term. So even from an Israeli perspective, I think the benefits aren't that great. Final point, I'll remind everybody, if you're really worried about the Iranian nuclear capability at some point down the road, the United States has thousands of nuclear weapons. Israel has several hundred nuclear weapons. So even if Iran got a bomb of its own, which I hope doesn't happen, they could never use it without causing their own destruction. And that ought to be borne in mind, too.
Just one very quick point on that. If you look at who's pushing the United States to use military force against Iran, there's only one country in the world that is in favor of the military option, and that's Israel. And if you look inside the United States at who's pushing the president and the administration and presidential candidates and Congress to use military force against Iran, it's basically the main organizations and a lot of people from the lobby, and it's basically the same cast of characters that pushed hard for the war in Iraq. Sir?
My name is Daniel Isaac. I'm a local rabbi and Zionist, so I guess I'm part of the Israel lobby.
Not necessarily.
Even so, I have great concerns and problems, and part of that 87% that you spoke about of American Jews and the majority of Israelis who favor a two-state solution, which I think is basically the Israeli policy. I want to ask really a question that's based on the napkin story, because there's something that sort of undermines both the article that I read that you published and tonight's presentation that smacks of something very sinister, that there's something sinister going on. Now, if Israel has a legitimate right to exist and to have policies that it feels are in its favor, and if lobbies are totally legitimate, and Israel is perhaps a very effective lobby, but a lobby, then it seems to me that the source of that which is sinister is weak-kneed politicians. Not just weak-kneed politicians, Republicans, Democrats, legislatures, executives, presidents all down the line. That seems to be the problem here, is that you have presidents, is that you have everybody in the American
okay.
This is the problem, that your complaint is about our political system and our current politicians, and not with Israel or the Israel lobby.
Look, we did not use the word sinister.
And I did. But you say that a politician can get 70 signatures on a napkin in an hour
Please let him explain his question.
You should finish your comments and then let me go. You done? We did not use the word sinister. The argument that we made is that the lobby is a good old-fashioned interest group. And that in the American political system, interest groups can punch above their weight. Let's just take the National Rifle Association. We do not like, neither Steve nor I, the policies that the National Rifle Association pushes. The fact is that most politicians are afraid to stand up to the National Rifle Association because of just the way interest group politics works. You can say that those politicians are weak-kneed. That's fine. I think that's basically true, right? But that doesn't mean that the NRA is sinister or that it's a cabal or a conspiracy or that there's anything illicit going on. The NRA is operating inside the American political system the way interest groups have from the beginning and will probably for as long as this country is around. The same thing is true with the Israel lobby. There's nothing sinister about this. This is an organization, a set of organizations and individuals that have a lot of power and put tremendous pressure on politicians inside the Beltway and on policymakers to pursue pro-Israel policies. That's the way American politics works. It's not sinister. Our point is that we should be able, as Americans, to talk about that and to criticize the lobby, to criticize Israel, and to criticize the U.S.-Israeli relationship. But it is almost impossible to do that in the United States. And the fact that you disagree with us is wonderful because that's what the American system is all about. It's people getting up and having a debate about serious policy issues. But again, this is a subject on which we have not had much debate in the past because there's been only one side in the debate, and that's the pro-Israel side.
Question, Yael Doreen Goodman, liberal, Zionist. For a long time. You present yourself as being somewhat victimized by the Israeli lobby. There is so much collusion to criticize you. But in fact, when it came to speaking on campuses, Benjamin Netanyahu, Daniel Pipes, David Horowitz were not allowed, neither was the vice counsel in San Francisco for Israel, who happens to be a Bedouin, and a Muslim, and he was shocked and personally told a group that he was shocked he was not allowed to speak on the Berkeley campus. And when finally he got permission, no Muslims came to the address. The question is, since your academic credentials are extremely high and you present yourself as scholars, I wonder about your primary research. I'd like to know who you interviewed in Israel, how many times you've been to Israel when you suggest they wanted the war, especially now planning for the war in Iran. And I'd like to know what higher-ups and officials you spoke to personally and got their opinion rather than second-hand or third-hand.
Yeah, I think those two comments are somewhat disconnected. I'll just say that with respect to the first one, I think it's deplorable when people are not allowed to speak at universities, even if they're people whose views I disagree with. So the incidents you pointed to, I would not have favored censoring them, even though I'd have pretty substantial disagreements with what they said. With respect to our research, there are, I think, if I remember right, 106 pages of footnotes in the book. If you buy the book, you can read the footnotes. We talked to a number of people in Washington. We surveyed very carefully many parts of the Israeli press. You'll find that there are lots of sources there, Haaretz. And remember, our book is about the Israeli lobby, which is here in the United States, and U.S. foreign policy. So interviewing people in Israel, although it can be helpful, wasn't really central to what we were doing. I don't know, and by the way, I have been to Israel and I had a wonderful time there.
I planned to be succinct, so I'll say thank you. Thank you both. But before I get to my question, I just want to sneak in another napkin story. And out of the sinister, it's not a story, it's a sentence. It's about the napkins. It's about Mr. Rosen, Steve Rosen. I'm not sure if everyone here is aware that he's indicted, disgraced, and pending.
He's also innocent until proven guilty.
Correct. And his quote, and no longer is he the head of AIPAC, one of the two top heads of AIPAC. He and Steve Wisen wait trial, many delays. Larry Franklin is already in jail. My quote that I bring to you, dear Rabbi, is that he himself is quoted as having said that a lobby is like a night flower. It thrives in the night and wilts in the light of day. So maybe that goes a little toward your hunch that there might be something amiss.
Can I comment on that?
Please.
I actually think that's a mischaracterization of the Israel lobby.
Yeah.
And let's just take AIPAC, which he worked for. AIPAC is an out in the open, bold, and in your face kind of organization. And I say that with respect. The idea that it's sort of working behind the scenes like a cabal, a conspiracy, bears little resemblance to reality. In fact, in the old days, when we first started doing research on this subject, AIPAC used to advertise its power on its website. Just go look at its website sometime. For those of you who haven't Googled AIPAC, go to its website. It's not something that's operating in the dark. I mean, I understand why Steve Rosen said that, but it's just simply not true. And talking about it in those terms lends credence to this notion that we're talking about a cabal or a conspiracy.
And
which
that
is
was a few years ago. So my question is that you had mentioned there were, in the 8 months, first 8 months of the Bush administration, they weren't successful in selling the Iraq war. I wonder, those PNAC letters, I wonder if you could expound a little bit on what they did, that what could you point to that shows us that they were trying to sell the Iraq war prior to 9/11. Also, I guess, could you expound just a little on the Office of Special Plans and those key players? Thanks.
Well, you want me to do it?
Go ahead, and I want to make another point when you're done.
Yeah, just very quickly. There were two letters that were sponsored by the neoconservatives that were written to President Clinton in early 1998, signed by all sorts of prominent people. And at the same time, they gave congressional testimony, wrote articles, and gave speeches in the subsequent years advocating the use of military force to topple Saddam. And they never got up ahead of steam, and as I say, never convinced President Clinton that it would be a good idea. With regard to the Office of Special Plans, this was this operation that was set up in the Pentagon to basically help sell the Iraq war after 9/11. It included a handful of people like Barry Rubin, and it got a lot of attention for a while, but it's kind of disappeared off the radar screen, and hardly anybody talks about it, and there have been no big studies on what it was up to, who the key players were, and what sort of real influence they had in the process. So I think we're just going to have to wait for more information before we can say anything definitive or close to being definitive about OSP.
Yeah, I want to just add something that relates more to your earlier comments. John and I don't think there would actually be anything wrong with having a powerful and politically influential pro-Israel community in the United States if those groups were pushing for a set of policies that made more sense from both our perspective, that is to say the American perspective, but also, I would argue, from the Israeli perspective. Right? The fact is that the most powerful institutions and organizations within the lobby have been pushing policies that, in my view, have been very harmful to Israel itself by making it impossible, for example, for the United States to put an end to the settlement enterprise, right, which has now gone on for 40 years. Right? They have unwittingly done great harm to Israel itself. Some groups in the lobby, like the Israel Policy Forum, for example, doesn't support the settlement enterprise, would be opposed to that. If those groups were more influential, having a very powerful pro-Israel community, but one pushing, again, a more sensible set of policies would be good. The key to understand here is that the United States would, in fact, be a better friend to Israel if we were able to do what friends do for each other, which is occasionally tell your friends when they're going off the rails, when they're heading in the wrong direction. So either the settlements, or if you look at what happened in Lebanon in the summer of 2006, we would have been a better ally, we would have been a better friend for Israel if we had either told the Israelis to come up with a better strategy for dealing with Hezbollah, or if we'd gotten that war ended with a ceasefire very quickly as opposed to helping keep it going for several weeks. Right? We were not a good friend to Israel, and one of the reasons we weren't a good friend to Israel because we couldn't have an honest discussion here in the United States on American policy.
Thank you.
Yes.
First of all, I'd like to thank the World Affairs Council for bringing these two gentlemen here. This is outstanding debate and discussion, and I want to thank the two scholars for their outstanding work. It really is timely and very much needed in the United States at this time. My question focuses in on Rudy Giuliani. If you take a look at all the candidates, as you mentioned, they're all basically trying to one-up each other on their professed support for the state of Israel. But Rudy Giuliani stands out in the sense that he surrounded himself with neocons, people like Daniel Pipes, who said some pretty outrageous things in the past. Can you expand on where you see that going, especially in light of our trajectory as we move towards Iran? Where's this all headed?
Well, I think there's no question that Rudy Giuliani, as you described, has surrounded himself with a bevy of neoconservatives, people like Daniel Pipes and Norman Podhoretz, who are remarkably hawkish in their views about American foreign policy and who are deeply interested in seeing the United States use military force against Iran. One would presume that if Giuliani were elected, that there would probably be a better than 50-50 chance that we would use military force against Iran, given the advisors that he has surrounded himself with. I don't think there's too much more to say beside that on this matter.
There is actually one more thing to say. If you like Dirac, you'll love the Giuliani foreign policy.
Professor Wall, I think you said that Israel is no worse or better than other nations, and yet they frequently terrorize civilian populations. Palestinians, the Lebanese, they illegally occupy Syrian land, Lebanese land, Palestinian land. Can you not say that Israel is really a rogue state, second only to the United States?
I'm not going to go there. But I will say, I think if we are honest about our own country and its history, and if you look at the behavior of other countries around the world, most countries have some pretty sordid episodes in their history. Most societies that I know about have done some pretty awful things to one group or another. Every country whose history I know well, I can point to various things they've done. And my only point is I'm not going to single out Israel as having behaved substantially worse than other countries when I think of all of the horrible things that other countries have done. Moreover, I have a certain degree of sympathy for the security situation that Israel has been in for at least its early history. I think its security situation since 1967 has been substantially better than many Americans actually believe. My only point was that you can't look at that history, I think, honestly, and say its conduct has been so exemplary, so above the mean for the world's nations, that it deserves the special treatment that it gets from the United States. But again, I think, you know, there's lots of judgment to go around.
I guess keeping in mind what you said about the constant power of the long-time power of the AIPAC organization, and then also with your premise that if Gore had been elected, that we wouldn't necessarily be involved in Iraq, maybe before, maybe now. I'm wondering if you could talk to the notion or the concept of why a neocons and the current administration seem to be more susceptible to what might be perceived as a biased political actor as Israel, as maybe other groups of political leaders in the United States are.
I don't think there's much difference between Republicans and Democrats on this issue. I mean, Bill Clinton was every bit as susceptible to the pressures of the lobby as George Bush has been. And for anybody who thinks that Hillary Clinton's going to be an improvement over Bush in terms of U.S. Middle East policy and standing up to the lobby, you're living in a dream world. And the previous gentleman back here just told you the story with Rudy Giuliani. And I think it's fair to say that Giuliani and Clinton are both the front runners at this point in time. And there's not much difference between them and President Bush. With regard to Al Gore, if you go back and research the question of how closely linked Al Gore is with the lobby, you'll see that he's had a long-standing, intimate relationship with the lobby. He just fortunately had the good sense to be against the Iraq war. But if he were elected president, if he were to come into the race and he were to win in 2008, Al Gore, that is, there'd be no substantial change in American policy towards Israel.
It seems to me that a lot of your argument that the lobby is responsible or a prime mover of U.S. Middle Eastern policy depends on your assumption that Israel is not a strategic asset. And I wonder why you don't draw the distinction between whether or not Israel is a strategic asset for me or for you or for the other people who are assembled here, and whether or not it is considered to be and believed to be a strategic asset by the hegemonists who make our foreign policy.
Okay. I think it's hard to make the argument any longer that it's an asset, even if I accepted the premise for the hegemonists that run our foreign policy. As I indicated in my remarks, let me answer the question, please. As I indicated in my remarks, you can make an argument that during the Cold War it was something of an asset for the United States because it was helping us deal with various Soviet client states in the region, and it forced the Soviet Union to expend a lot of resources there. But again, the Cold War came to an end, and you actually, if you go back and look, in the early 1990s, the Israelis understood that they no longer had that argument to make, and they began, you can even find people like Bernard Lewis, who's quite pro-Israel, saying at the time of the first Gulf War that Israel is no longer a strategic asset for the United States. He even uses the word liability. So then the question you have to ask now is, well, what's Israel doing for us? There's certainly some military cooperation of various kinds. We get some intelligence from them, not a huge amount, but we get some. We learn some things from techniques that they develop. So there's some positive benefits on a purely strategic basis. But you have to put on the other side, right, all of the strategic consequences of it undermining our image around the world. It's certainly causing us, as John documented, lots of problems with Arab and Muslim societies. And then you ask, well, okay, but when the United States really gets in trouble in the Middle East and has to do something, it can count on the Israelis. Well, if you remember the first Gulf War, 1990-91, when we threw Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, Israel did not participate in that war. Israel was actually attacked in that war, and the United States had to divert some resources to help protect Israel. It's not because the Israelis wouldn't have been willing to, but they couldn't participate because, of course, the Arab coalition would have fallen apart if the Israelis had gotten involved, which, of course, is why Saddam Hussein attacked them, trying to draw them in so the coalition would fall apart. Then when we attacked Iraq in 2003, same story. We were desperately trying to get a coalition of the willing together, but we, of course, couldn't ask the Israelis because, again, for political reasons, it would have undermined our effort to rally support in other parts of the world. So it's not clear to me that Israel's being much of a strategic asset when the United States is actually using force in the region. Final point, I believe that if we did get a two-state solution, if the Palestinians did have a state of their own, if the Arab countries made peace, as they have pledged to do in the Saudi peace plan, then Israel starts becoming precisely the kind of strategic asset that its supporters often claim it is. because it no longer would be a pariah within the region. Getting help from Israel wouldn't alienate other countries in the region. So in a sense, if you want Israel to be a strategic asset for the United States, we need to end the occupation, get a two-state solution, and have a final lasting peace between Israel and its various neighbors.
Reed Chomsky, as we end our enterprise in Iraq, should we expect that the groups that lobby for Israel will come to a united position on how we should end that enterprise? And if so, what will they be advocating, and how successful do you think they will be in dictating how we end that enterprise?
I don't think that we're going to end the Iraqi enterprise anytime soon. I think we're there for the foreseeable future. I think that many of the pro-Israel forces that pushed us into that war, including the neoconservatives and organizations like AIPAC, have no clear idea on how to get us out. I don't think anybody has any clear idea how to get us out. And I think there are very powerful forces pushing us to stay there. I think that both the Israeli government and large elements of the lobby worry greatly that if the United States gets out of Iraq, it will physically remove its military forces from the Middle East the way it did during the Cold War. And they would prefer that we not do that. Just to give you a little bit of history here, it's very important to understand that during the Cold War, the United States acted like an offshore balancer in the Middle East. We did not physically station troops in the Middle East. We stayed offshore. You all remember in 1979 when the Shah got toppled, and the Shah had done a lot of our heavy lifting for us in the Middle East. We then had to build a rapid deployment force. Remember that rapid deployment force that was designed to go into the Middle East if the bear came across the mountains and went into Iran, or if Iran or Iraq tried to dominate the region, we'd bring in the RDF. The RDF was over the horizon. There was only one time we made the mistake of physically stationing troops in the Middle East. That's when the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 82, and we were forced to go into Beirut because they caused such a mess. Remember, we got whacked, the Marine barracks, 241 Americans were killed. Remember what Ronald Reagan did? He talked tough, and then he pulled those forces out and stayed out because he understood that if you start occupying countries in the Arab and Islamic world, you get your snout whacked, right? So we were an offshore balancer during the Cold War. But then after the first Gulf War, we decided to stay in the Middle East, right, and pursue a policy of dual containment where we stayed in the region and we tried to contain both Iraq and Iran by ourselves instead of playing them off against each other. The Israel lobby was very important in pushing us to adopt that policy of dual containment. And then we abandoned dual containment under George Bush, and we adopted a policy of regime change. Not only were we going to deter both Iraq and Iran, those were the Clinton years, we then decided under George Bush that we were going to start invading countries in the Arab and Islamic world, specifically in the Middle East, and we were going to turn them into democracies at the end of a rifle barrel. And what Steve and I would like to do is go back to the policy which we pursued in the Cold War, which is to get offshore and only come in when you absolutely have to. And if an Iran and Iraq decide they don't like each other and want to fight it out, that's their business, not ours. We just want to make sure that nobody wins and dominates the region. Both the Israeli government and the lobby do not have any interest in seeing us pull out of the Middle East and adopt an offshore balancing policy. And that's one of the reasons that the Israeli government and many of the major organizations in the lobby have been leaning on us to stay in Iraq. And again, what's very interesting about this is if you look at the survey data on the American Jewish community, there's more support in the American Jewish community for getting out of Iraq than there is in the body politic at large, which shows you the difference between the lobby on one hand and the American Jewish community on the other. But ladies and gentlemen, all you have to do is listen to the Democratic candidates talk about Iraq, and you know we ain't getting out of there anytime soon.
pretend that America's support for Israel angers the Muslim world, and this just is one of many things about America that angers the Muslim world, such as our commitment to women's rights, minority rights, gay rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, social equality, tolerance, diversity. Would you please be polite?
Please let him ask his question.
Thank you. Thank you. Social equality, tolerance, diversity, etc. These emanate from our nation's most deeply held and passionate beliefs, principles, and values. Here's my question. Do you really believe that we should change them merely because they anger the Muslim world?
I don't accept the premise of the question, and there's actually a considerable amount of survey evidence. People do social and political surveys in the Arab and Islamic world, and they're quite instructive. And one of the things they show is there's actually a surprising amount of support for what you would call American values. It's not what I would call overwhelming, not 90%, not 80%. But if you look at these surveys, they show that in many Arab and Islamic countries, there's great admiration for the American economy. There's great admiration for the American system of government. They would actually prefer to have a system of government that looks a lot more like ours as opposed to the ones that they've got. There's even actually surprising a degree of admiration for the Israeli system of government among the Palestinian population. For all of the problems that the Israeli government has, it looks a lot better than the one that the Palestinians have had over the years. There is surprising support for American culture, right? American culture, of course, is quite addictive, as we all know, right? But then if you start asking questions, how do you feel about American policy towards the Middle East in general, towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, towards terrorism, etc., then the numbers go sharply, overwhelmingly negative. You know, 3% support, 97% opposition, which is one of the reasons why anyone who's looked carefully at this realizes that most of the animosity directed towards the United States and the Arab and Islamic world is a reaction to American policy. Now, you may think that those policies are the right policies, but those are the things that are driving that animosity. One final point is, I am certain that there are some extremists who are motivated by the kinds of things that you mentioned. They are fortunately a very, very, very small number, right, in the Arab and Islamic world. And my point is, I want to keep those people as marginalized and as discredited as possible, and the way to do that is have an American policy that's much easier for us to defend in that part of the world among the vast majority of those populations.
Sir.
All right. My question is our current administration's policy of complete non-nuclear proliferation in Iran not more systemic and reflective of our general NPT advocation, or is it something of more state-level analysis because Israel's vital interests are at stake with a nuclear-capable Iran? In other words, what extent does the Israel lobby affect our policy towards Iran, and would it be any different if the Israel lobby were not in any effect?
There's no question that the United States would be deeply concerned about Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, whether there was a state of Israel or not. As you know, the United States is deeply committed to preventing proliferation. In May 1998, when the Indians and the Pakistanis tested their nuclear weapons, the United States went ballistic. We did not like that at all, right? Because we do not like nuclear proliferation. We've been very angry at both the Indians and the Pakistanis for not signing the NPT. Okay, so independent of Israel, we would be deeply concerned about what Iran is doing, okay? But the two points I would make about Israel is that, first of all, we would not be seriously countenancing using military force against Iran were it not for pressure from Israel and for pressure from the lobby. Second, if you're interested in solving the problem with Iran, the best way to do it is through diplomacy and removing the threat of military force, not by confronting Iran. Iran is not stupid. It understands that the United States invaded Iraq and Iraq had no nuclear weapons. It understands also that the United States has no intention of invading North Korea because North Korea has nuclear weapons. It understands full well, Iran does, that if it had nuclear weapons, the United States would not be talking about attacking it, nor would Israel.
Nuclear weapons are a wonderful deterrent if you feel threatened. As you well know, Israel has nuclear weapons. Do you think Israel has nuclear weapons because it's evil? I don't think that. Israel has nuclear weapons for good reason. It thinks it lives in a dangerous neighborhood, its survival is threatened, and therefore it has to have nuclear weapons to protect itself. The same thing goes with the United States. You haven't noticed the United States making any moves to get rid of its nuclear weapons now that the Cold War ended, and we're the most powerful state on the face of the earth and can whip anybody out there conventionally. We're still not getting rid of our nuclear weapons. Why? Because we understand they're a great deterrent. Well, don't you think the Iranians have figured out the same basic logic? And don't you think by putting your mailed fist in their face and telling them that you're coming after them, you're going to give them very powerful incentives to get nuclear weapons? I think the answer is yes to that question. I think the best way to deal with them is to back off, do everything you can to remove the threat to their survival, and see if you can negotiate yourself out of this mess. Because again, the United States does deeply care about this issue.
Thank you. I would also like to second the people.
No, it's
her turn.
You can go next.
That was
I thought your voice
strange.
Sounded a little
I know,
strange.
No, me too. It's like, my God, sex change, instantaneous. My name is Jordana Sardo. I'm the Portland organizer of the Freedom Socialist Party, and I do thank you for your presentations tonight. I am a little troubled, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what is the role, the corporate interests in the Middle East? And I understand and I understand about the influence of the Israel lobby, but what about the influence of the corporate drive for profits? And isn't that what truly at the heart of things drives the U.S. foreign policy in terms of domination, not just of the Middle East, but all over the place? And in your some of the things you suggested in terms of changing the relations between the United States and Israel, does that include stopping funding to Israel, which seems to be have a history of perpetuating the occupation in land that doesn't belong to them?
Let me take a whack at the first part of it, the corporate interests. Most of the Middle East is not, with the exception of oil, is not a huge trading partner for the United States, given the size of most of those economies. So it's not a critical part of the American economy. We trade a lot more with Asian powers, with Europe, than we do with most of the Middle East, leaving oil aside. And then the oil point, I mean, what are the corporate interests of oil companies? It's to make money, right? And what do they want? They don't want sanctions. Right? Sanctions interfere with them going in and pumping oil out and shipping it off and selling it and making money. They would like to develop Iran's oil fields for them. But back in the 90s, when Conoco signed a deal with the Iranian government to develop some of their oil fields, the Clinton administration, pushed, by the way, by AIPAC and others, nixed the deal, barred it. So here's a case where an American oil company was about to go make some money in Iran, but for other reasons, we got in the way. Vice President Cheney, who is, I believe, a big fan of corporate America, and ran Halliburton, a major oil services company, complained in the 1990s when he was running Halliburton about what he called America's sanctions-happy foreign policy. He didn't like sanctions on Iraq. He didn't like sanctions on Iran when he was running Halliburton. So again, it's not obvious to me that on this set of issues, corporations are really driving the train of American policy. I think that this is a case where there's a lot of potential money being left on the table by a foreign policy that's a bit misguided.
Sure.
Excuse me, before we get to the next question, I just wanted to, we are going to cap the lines where they are now, keeping in mind that our two presenters, for them it's midnight, and we also want to have time for them to sign books. So actually, if you could have brief and simple questions, that would be even better.
And easy to answer.
Easy, very easy. One-word answers would be great.
My question is brief, and thank you. Just to extend thank you again for coming and bringing this dialogue to Portland. And that I do agree that with you, if I understand your statement correctly, that it's okay and we should be able to be critical of Israel's policies without being under the constant charge of scrutiny and anti-Semitism. However, I am somewhat surprised on one statement, if I understood it correctly, regarding the significant lack or lack of non-Israeli, be it other Middle East countries, Arab Islamic dollars that are put into the U.S. To affect public policy, public opinion, or foreign policy. While not PAC dollars, I think if you do the research, it's fairly easy to document the millions of dollars that are funneled into American universities and academia.
There's a question here, right?
Well, the question is, my understanding is that Prince Walid bin Tal recently gave, in a short time ago, a $20 million grant to Harvard University to promote Islamic learning. I was just wondering if that was correct.
Yeah, a couple of points here. Yes, I believe that's correct. I believe it went to the Harvard Divinity School, by the way, which is, if you know anything about Harvard's finances, all of the different schools are independent. It didn't go, for example, to the Kennedy School. The second thing is that universities have lots of rules on donors having to be hands-off and to just pick an obvious choice. The person who gave the money for the chair that I sit in, right, is a very successful Jewish American businessman, right? I don't know if he agrees or disagrees with my views, but the point is he has no control over what the person, first of all, he didn't have any influence on who Harvard put in the chair, and of course he doesn't have any influence on what I say, and that's entirely appropriate. That's the way universities work. So you give money to a university, you can't be sure who the university is going to put in the chair or what they're going to say. And finally, if you wanted to do that, you would have obviously have to try and evaluate, well, see how much money is coming from, say, a Saudi prince and how much money is coming from other donors as well. And I can give you a long list of very pro-Israel donors to Harvard University as well.
Thank you.
I was wondering if either of you could indulge me in answering what might possibly be diplomatic progress that could happen in the upcoming peace conference that the United States is hosting in Annapolis, specifically regarding the Israeli-Palestinian or Arab, wider Arab-Israeli situation.
There's not going to be any progress. It's all basically a charade. And the principal reason, it's not the only reason, but the principal reason is the Israelis have no intention of abandoning the occupied territories and giving the Palestinians a viable state. What is basically going on here is that the Israelis are interested in keeping a large presence in large portions of the West Bank and confining the Palestinians to a handful of enclaves in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. And as long as that's the case, you're never going to settle this conflict. There's only one way this conflict is going to be settled, and that's for the United States to put significant pressure on both the Israelis and the Palestinians to create a viable state. And because of the lobby, that's simply not going to happen. So my opinion, we'll be lucky if we have a conference, and if we do have a conference, it'll be a meaningless conference, and it will lead to nowhere, as all past conferences have led to nowhere.
Bummer.
My question actually relates to that also. If were the U.S. to actually put significant pressure on the Palestinians to abandon their or the Israelis to abandon their settlements in the Palestinian territory, and the Palestinians and Israelis agreed to come to a peace table to create a viable Palestinian state, would you see that ever actually happening, simply due to the fact that the Palestinians would demand as a capital Jerusalem and the Israelis would never give that up? And would the United States, because of our past relationship with Israel, would they even be the best broker for the Palestinians and Israelis to sit down at a table to?
First of all, to have a viable Palestinian state, the Palestinians have to get East Jerusalem as a capital. And many Israelis understand understand that full well. You're just not going to have a deal. The most difficult issue to settle, in my opinion, is the question of the holy sites. It's very hard to figure out how to deal with that. But the question of refugees, the question of borders, the question of East Jerusalem, I think that's pretty open and shut. We know what the deal looks like there. The question is, can we put pressure on the Israelis to reach an agreement? And we're also going to have to work very hard with the Palestinians, because now we